And hello, thank you so much for joining us today right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We bring you The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z every Tuesday, 10 to 11 a.m. New York time, right here on Progressive Radio Network. That's Gary Knowles Network. But you can catch us anytime, day or night, 24 hours a day from wherever you are, which is really a great plus in terms of listening to any show here on Progressive Radio Network. All you have to do is go to the archive, look for the show you'd like to listen to, and this show is The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, but all of our shows are fantastic. And just click and listen. They make it extremely easy. Visit the archives at prn.fm. And Dr. Zamperone and I would like to invite you to join us in person at many of our up-and-coming lectures and presentations across the country. And you can go to naturalnurse.com and click on schedules to view that. For instance, we're having an herb walk right in Chinatown where we learn all about edible and medicinal plants. And you can see what date by going to naturalnurse.com. It's coming up in the fall. In addition, we have a very special lecture, and this is opened to both the public and health professionals, although the language, I will tell you, is for health professionals, and it also offers 5 CEU credits. It's called the Evidence-Based Natural and Complementary Medicine Symposium, and it is being put on by a combined effort of Stony Brook University and the University of Bridgeport, because I'm an instructor at Stony Brook University and Dr. Z is a professor at the University of Bridgeport, and they're getting together. This is the second year we've been doing this, which is excellent, and it is at the Southampton College. And also, rooms will be available if you wanted to stay over at a very reduced rate from what you could usually get if you go out to the Hamptons that time of year. So it offers 5 credits for any health professional, 5 CEU credits. And if you are a person of the public who does not require credits, you don't have to get them. That's fine. So if you'd like to join us for that adventure, do check out naturalnurse.com schedules. Today, we have as our guest Melanie Warner. Melanie is the author of Pandora's Lunchbox, How Processed Food Took Over the American Meal, and is a freelance writer for various publications, including the New York Times, Fast Company, and CBSNews.com. She has spent the past 15 years writing about business, and for 2 years she was a staff reporter for the New York Times, covering the food industry. And previously she spent years at Fortune magazine, where, among other things, she wrote about the dot-com boom. She lives in Colorado, so she's joining us today, early morning for her from there, with her husband and 2 children. Thank you so much for joining us today, Melanie.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Now, this book is really lays out a lot of things that are absolutely true, called Pandora's Lunchbox. How did you get inspired to write this book?
It started a number of years ago when I first actually started covering the food industry. It was about the mid-2000s. And pretty soon I started talking to food companies and people inside food companies, like food scientists, food technologists, people that I never really thought about or knew really existed. And they started telling me all these interesting things about the way food is produced. I remember one food scientist in particular explained that vegetable oil factories, these factories that make things like soybean oil or corn oil, have to be explosion-proof. And I thought, why does something that makes a food ingredient have to be explosion-proof? And it turns out it's because there's a neurotoxic flammable chemical that's used in the production of much vegetable oil. And the more I started talking to people and learning about the ways in which our food is produced, the more fascinated I became, and I wanted to learn more and more about it. I started going to conferences, some of these big conferences that the food industry holds, where ingredient companies sell this whole slew of ingredients that sometimes you see at the supermarket when you flip over packages and you look at all these ingredients and you wonder, what are all these things? These are all the things the ingredient companies within the food industry very assiduously and carefully creating and trying to sell to the food manufacturers. And when you go to these conferences, as I did around that time in the mid-2000s, you realize that the way that food scientists, these people that are creating these foods, these processed foods, the way they think about food is fundamentally different than the way you and I think about food and most people who are eating it think about it. You know, they think about food in terms of components, and essentially what they do is they break down food into its individual components and then re-engineer it back together. So it immediately struck me that this was a story that really hadn't been told, and this also the story of how our food production has changed over the last century, kind of the evolution, the slow evolution. That story hadn't been told. So that was really, it struck me at that time that this was a book.
Now, what about in terms of what you personally eat and feed your kids, since you're a mother as well?
Yeah, I mean, I try to practice what I preach, which is a diet mostly composed of real foods, which is to say, I mean, it's hard to exactly define that, but it's essentially fresh foods that are grown, not made, not engineered.
Yeah, I don't think that's hard to define. I think you're being very clear. And I will tell you, my own kids who are now reaching their 40s,
yeah,
we never had processed food in the house. Never. Not
mm-hmm.
one. And so that's how long I've been into this. And we watch the evolvement of what you're talking about in your fabulous book, Pandora's Lunchbox, and back, in fact, how processed food took over the American meal. And I would say there are now, like, the younger generation, maybe people even in their 20s, may have never eaten one molecule of what you're calling whole food or real food.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that's not the case, but I fear that you're right. That there are some people that have just come to accept these highly manufactured and engineered creations as food, but really they're not food in the traditional and real sense of it, which is things that provide nourishment for our body that help sustain us, that give us optimal health. You know, for a variety of reasons, these processed foods that I talk about in the book are lacking in nutrition, and they have a lot of negative components to them as well. And they're just, they're sort of killing us slowly, really, is what it is.
I totally agree. And you lay this out beautifully in your book, Pandora's Lunchbox. You talk about the fact that it's a new way of eating. It's not like we can go back three generations, even anyone listening today. If you think of your grandparents and certainly just one generation before that, they ate the way humans have eaten for the last 10,000 years, at least still by the time cooking, let's say, was invented versus just eating stuff raw out of the ground. So that's a long time ago.
Right. But since agriculture was invented 10,000 years ago, yeah.
Perfect. That's a great way to put it. And then we're looking at, in the last, you say 100 years, but how about the changes that have occurred even in, like, the last 50 years?
Yeah, well, I go back 100 years just because that's really when the whole industry around processed food first started. I mean, it was
very long ago. Okay.
Incipient, right, in around the turn of the 20th century. So that's when you can trace the first instances of it. It's when you saw the first ready-to-eat breakfast cereal, and you saw things like packaged cookies and things like that. But it was tiny, very, very small. And
then wouldn't you say at that time they were still actually using real ingredients, or were they already using, you know, like structured processed ingredients?
Well, it was more, they were using, I guess you could say, for the most part, more real ingredients than are being used today. But there were still, I wrote about a character in the book that raised a lot of alarms around that time, around the turn of the century, because food producers were using all these horrible chemicals, I mean, even worse than what we're using today, things like formaldehyde and borax and things like that for preservatives in food. So it was around the time when chemistry was really gaining momentum, And there was a lot of experimentation with putting strange things into food. It was right around the time that people stopped growing. A lot of Americans stopped growing their own food, and it was urban migration. They moved to the cities, so they needed to rely on other people to produce their food, and not just processed food, but, you know, to produce their meat and their vegetables and all this.
So that was the beginning of it, and I guess led it to continue to develop was the fact that financially it was kind of great.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was a whole industry built up around it. And you're right that there's really been a big increase in the last 40 years. In the post-war II era, when food companies really started to try and market a lot of these ready-made meals to housewives. It wasn't immediate. I mean, a lot of housewives didn't actually immediately open arms, embrace TV dinners and Betty Crocker cake mixes and things like that. It took a while, but eventually it caught on. And then, especially when women started going into the workforce in larger numbers, these prepackaged foods made a lot of sense. It was time-saving, convenient, and whatnot. And then
there's a fun factor that I think they built into it, because I actually remember being a little kid. My mother cooked a whole meal three times a day. You know, she was a stay-at-home kind of person. And that was great. And once a week, we were allowed to have a TV dinner. And as kids, we really looked forward to that. We thought it was so cute.
Exactly. I mean, it can be fun. And I'm not arguing in the book that no one should ever eat processed food. It can have its role in our busy lives, and it certainly provides a measure of convenience. And they can be fun to eat, but I think they have to be, you know, sometimes food. They have to be something that you have on certain occasions when you can't cook, or when you just, you know, want a break and you want to go out to eat or pull out something from the freezer. Not something that we rely on every day, like the foundation of our diets.
Now, you have documented in your book, Pandora's Lunchbox, that the nutritional content of food has been vastly changed due to the increased reliance and ingestion on highly processed food. For instance, you point out double the amount of added fat, 60% more sugar, 3.5 times more sodium, half the fiber, and very high quantities of soy and corn.
Right.
How did that develop?
That's something that the issue with processed food, it has in it some of the negative ingredients that are in we find in excess in processed foods, like salt, which you know, creates excessive sodium levels in our diets. Sugar, processed food is a lot of sugar. Sometimes it's hidden sugar, like in things like pasta sauce and other types of sauces that you don't think it's going to be in. And excessive quantities of fat, certainly in fast food and fried food. And then all these chemical or, quasi-chemical additives, which are really, you know, a lot of them, when you look at them, are not really meant to be consumed. I mean, these are not edible ingredients. They're not technically food.
Well, give us an example of that.
Well, the sort of more egregious example that I talk about in the book is this this dough conditioner that you find in a lot of breads. You find it in fast food breads and then sometimes at the supermarket. It's a little hard to pronounce, but it's called azotocarbamide, and it's been used for many years by the food industry, and it actually breaks down into an industrial chemical. It's used in the creation of foam plastics, things like yoga mats and rubber mats, things like that.
Ow, tell us that again. Wait a minute. Tell us that again. That's pretty shocking news.
Yeah, azotocarbamide. And and the troubling thing is, not only is it an industrial chemical that really shouldn't be going into food, it's been shown to break down into a breakdown chemical called semicarbazide that is known to be carcinogenic, and it breaks down when it's heated, such as in the manufacturing of bread products.
So
Who
allowed this to be added to our foods with the kind of information? Yeah. Is it that it was grandfathered in before we knew all this negative information?
Yeah, I mean, these tests showing exactly, I mean, our scientific methods for testing things have gotten more and more precise, so we can test things we couldn't before. And sometimes it's just a matter of looking, too. I mean, there's actually 5,000 or more than 5,000 different additives that can go into food in the U.S., so that's just a huge, huge number And who's really overseeing this? I mean, the FDA just doesn't have the resources to look at all this. So these tests showing that azithromycin breaks down into this known carcinogen were done within the last 10 years. So it's a relatively recent development.
Wow. That's a lot of information. And the thing is, yes, the looking into it is a recent development, but meanwhile, it's been, as you said, in the last 100 years and certainly more recently, expanding tremendously into where you're talking about 70% of most people's calories are coming from processed food.
Exactly. Yeah, that was a recent analysis that was done looking in, looking specifically at highly processed food, which is what we're really talking about when we talk about processed food. We're not talking about all these kind of minimally processed foods, which are like frozen vegetables or bagged baby carrots, cans of beans, things like that. Things that, you know, essentially retain their natural structure. Those are these minimally processed foods, which are actually quite nutritious and very convenient and readily available at the supermarket. The processed foods, I mean, my working definition of processed food is a product that you could not make at home in your home kitchen if you wanted to, using the same ingredients listed on the package. So if you apply that definition, it applies to sort of a startling number of products at the grocery store and at fast food restaurants.
Wow. You know, I think that most people really need to know this, and one of the things around that is shopping, Michael Pollan talks about shopping the edge of the grocery store, because that's where you're finding things, you know, organic is best, but even if it's not organic, you know, it's an apple. It's like a piece of food. I mean, then, of course, you can upgrade to get less pesticide residue, fresher, locally grown. You know, that's going the next step. But just getting away from even having processed food in the house, well, we're talking about using it as the main part of food ingestion, which is just total madness, really.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people like to say that, oh, well, eating healthy is so expensive and not everyone can do it. But it's really a myth. It's really not true. I mean, there's certain things that are very expensive. Fish, for instance, is very expensive. Fresh blueberries can be very expensive. But there's plenty of fresh food at most supermarkets and Walmarts and Targets now. That's healthy, and it just sometimes requires a little preparation. So it gets to the question, which Michael Pollan has talked a lot about the need to do a little bit of cooking at home. Sometimes,
exactly.
And
it
could
be very little bit
ourselves in our kitchen.
So we're going to just take a little, our first break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right here on Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. And when we come back, we will continue our discussion with author Melanie Warner on her book, Pandora's Lunchbox, How Processed Food Took Over the American Meal. We'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the ancient Chinese science and art of acupuncture.
Acupuncture is a 5,000-year-old medical procedure involving insertion and manipulation of needles into specific points on the body. It is often applied to relieve pain during surgery and for many other conditions.
Acupuncture needles have been found in China that are over 4,000 years old. The first needles were made of stone. Later, bronze, gold, or silver was used, and today they are usually made from steel. Acupuncture was developed around the theory of special meridian points on the body connected to the internal organs, and that vital energy, or qi, flows along these meridians. According to this theory, diseases are caused by interrupted energy flow, and the stimulation of these points restores normal energy circulation. There is some scientific evidence of the existence of the meridians as a separate circulatory system. Studies were done in the 1970s by a Dr. Kim from Korea, where he injected radioactive dyes into the traditional acupuncture points. He observed migration of the dyes along the exact predicted path of the meridians.
How acupuncture works remains uncertain, but Both Western and Eastern scientific studies on rabbits have shown that the analgesic effects are not simply a matter of suggestion. After the discovery in 1975 of endorphins, natural pain inhibitors in the body, some neurophysiologists suggested that the needles may trigger the release of these substances. American and Chinese studies have confirmed that placing acupuncture needles in the brains of dogs raises the level of endorphins in the spinal fluid.
Acupuncture is used today in most hospitals in China and by many private practitioners in virtually every country in the world, including the United States. The primary use is for analgesia, although ulcers, hypertension, asthma, and other conditions have been documented to respond favorably to this treatment. Chinese surgeons prefer acupuncture to the use of drug-induced analgesia because they claim it does not disturb normal body physiology and therefore does not make the patient vulnerable to shock. Brain surgery is especially amenable to this form of analgesia when it is necessary to keep the patient awake during the operation.
Although some modifications in the practice of acupuncture have been made, such as sometimes using a small electric current on the needle instead of the traditional twirling, acupuncture remains intact as an ancient therapeutic technique that has been used successfully for at least 5,000 years. Perhaps you'd like to add this piece of knowledge to your natural medicine test.
And we're back right here on Natural Alternatives and the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we're very happy to be back today. We have as our guest the author of a great new book. You should have it on your bookshelf to protect yourself and your family. It's called Pandora's Lunchbox, How Processed Food Took Over the American Meal. And that's with Melanie Warner. She is the author of this book. And she is a longtime professional writer, having been a staff reporter for the New York Times and being very involved in reporting on the food industry. She's also written for Fortune magazine. And so you can imagine with all this writing experience, her book is really excellently well done, which it is, Melanie. And thank you for providing it to people where you're talking about the development of processed food and its inclusion in the American diet to the point of being 70% and probably more of what people eat. Just shocking.
It is. It is shocking, and you can see the effects that it's causing on our health. So there's
Let's
many,
talk about that. Because
chronic health
big.
Problems on the rise, yeah.
Except, do we really have good scientific data linking the decreased health to the increased consumption of these processed foods? Because I know it's true,
yeah.
But do we have good data where there's a link that we actually can point to?
Yeah, I mean there's a wide consensus among scientists that about 70% of our healthcare spending is related to preventable diseases. So these are things like heart disease, some forms of cancer, diabetes, various forms of inflammation-related disorders, sometimes asthma. And so these are attributable to lifestyle, which is a number of things, but diet is the biggest, very often, the biggest component of lifestyle. So there is a wide consensus among scientists that diet plays a huge role in what's going on with our health.
That's for sure. And I want to tell you, I started many years ago. I became a nurse in 1973. And at that time, when I worked in hospital settings, they called me the natural nurse, but in a derogatory way. That's now my registered trademark, because they said, oh, no, here comes the natural nurse. And I used to actually leave little notes on the refrigerator about the doctors and nurses' own lunches, which was nothing but junk processed food.
Yeah.
And I would actually print out, you know, in those days we didn't have the internet, I would just go to the library and make copies of journal articles showing that link, even though it was not regarded as true at that time.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I talked to a number of people when I was doing research on the book, people who had decided to cut way back on their consumption of processed food, or even in some cases for temporarily give up all processed food. And the thing that most of them initially told me, the difference that they felt after even just a week, was this huge increase in the amount of energy that they had and the way they felt day to day. So it's not just about eating so that you can live, you know, to be 90 years old. You know, it's about the day to day, how you feel day to day, and your health in the here and now. And I also talked to people who had amazing stories of how their change in diet helped various medical conditions that they had, whether it was acid reflux or behavioral disorders in their children. So diet can really have a huge impact on our health, just on a day-to-day level.
Another thing that you bring up, which I think is really fascinating, is even if something is from, let's say, a fancy grocery store, you know, we'll just name Whole Foods among many that offer lots of things that even have a certified organic certification right on the box from the USDA, that doesn't always mean it's not processed.
Right. Just because a Whole Foods or some other natural food store decides to sell a natural or organic version of Fruit Loops or Oreos doesn't mean that those products are healthy. They may be a little bit less bad because they're not going to have the food dyes in them and other additives, but they're still loaded. You know, they're still deficient in fiber, and they're loaded with sugar and fat and all that. So, I think you have to be careful not to go shopping at those stores and assume everything has a health halo on it.
Right. You do a very good job explaining that in that book, and you do name specific brands that, you know, shout out the organic nature, but all you have to do is turn it around, and you could look at the nutritional facts box and see how much sugar there is. There might be hydrogenated fats still in there. You're right. They're usually definitely better than their counterpart in the regular grocery store, which will then have FD&C, dye, red, four, blue, and everything else that they may
and
not
various
have.
Preservatives, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The other thing that you brought up earlier was, just briefly before we went to break, you talked about cost. And the thing is, to make a really good vegetable soup with cabbage, onions, garlic, rice, if you're not a vegetarian, even chicken, better yet, free-range chicken, but if not, regular chicken, really makes it so cost-effective, even to feed a large family on a low budget versus going out and buying, like, Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Yeah, exactly. There's so many examples of foods you can make at home for incredibly cheap. There's so many things, rice and beans, baked potatoes, things based with vegetables, which most vegetables aren't actually that expensive. Meats, you can go to the supermarket and actually look pound per pound. You can take some processed chicken product, you know, it's packaged in the frozen aisle, and compare it to the raw chicken breast that you find in the meat area, and ounce for ounce, the raw chicken is going to be less expensive. The trick is you have to cook it at home, but cooking chicken is not actually very difficult.
What is up with people, like, not seeming to be able to even turn their stove on? I mean, we're not saying you have to create a gourmet fest every day, and I do understand about working mothers.
Yeah.
I am one and have been one since my children were born 40 years ago. I worked through both of them growing up, but I just did carve out 2 hours a week, literally. Two hours a week, Sunday afternoon. I didn't schedule anything else, and I did prepare a week's worth of food, and I would make enough and then freeze stuff so it didn't go bad by the end of the week, take that frozen stuff out about halfway through, and, you know, I was able to feed them on like $100 a week.
That's what a lot of people do. They cook on the weekends or when they have time, and they cook extra and freeze it or keep it in the fridge so they have it during the week. I think that's a great strategy.
Right.
I use my grill all the time.
You could cut up a salad, just not put dressing on it, you know, so that it's ready to serve.
Right. Yeah, and cooking meat on the grill could not be easier. I mean, you throw chicken on there, you almost don't even have to put salt or pepper on it, and it tastes fantastic, and you can make that as a part of a meal. I mean, it takes no effort whatsoever, except buying the chicken and having it ready ahead of time.
So you do have a really big chapter in here about, vitamins. And the fact that people sometimes think they can just throw in a bunch of vitamins and offset the negative effects of eating all processed food. And you have some very eye-opening information about that.
Yeah, well, I talk about vitamins because it's one of the tricks that the processed food industry uses to make their products seem healthier than they are. So that you find this probably most intensely in the cereal aisle. It's almost impossible to walk down these huge cereal aisles and not find a box of cereal that has almost sometimes a dozen vitamins and minerals added to it. And the reason is because a lot of those packaged cereals don't actually have very much inherent nutrition, so they need to add the vitamins back in, usually at the end of the manufacturing process. Because what happens during a lot of manufacturing processes in these factories in the food industry is that these are very intense industrial processes and machines, and a lot of nutrition ends up getting destroyed. It's not something the food companies intend to happen, but it's kind of a byproduct. So they add in vitamins and minerals to try and put some of those nutrients back into the product.
And is that very helpful? And what is the quality of these additives?
Yeah, I mean that's a good question, and it's actually something I was startled to learn that scientists really haven't quite delved into to understand whether these synthetic manufactured added vitamins are actually the same, are actually the equivalent of what you're getting if you get them in whole foods. On one basic level, they're not, because when you're eating whole foods, you're getting a whole lot of other nutritional components. You're getting sometimes fiber. You're getting these sort of phytonutrients, which are chemicals that are found in plants, that like antioxidants. We're hearing a lot about these. Scientists are just starting to discover these compounds and the huge protective health effects that they may have. These things are not being added back into processed foods, so you're certainly not getting that. So it's very different taking a multivitamin or getting all these vitamins from cereal versus eating a carrot, eating an orange, or eating some other type of real food.
Yes, and you do point out also where these nutrients, these additive nutrients such as vitamins, how are they made and where are they made and from what are they made?
Yeah, I always assumed, I think, you know, I didn't think much about it, probably as most people don't, that I just assumed maybe they were coming somehow from the foods that contain them, like vitamin C maybe came from an orange, or vitamin A came from carrots. It's somehow that it was related to the food source. But it turns out that that's not the case at all. And a lot of these vitamins are manufactured through highly intense chemical processes. Some of the B vitamins start with coal tar chemicals. There's one manufacturing process that starts with a chemical that's a waste product from nylon manufacturing. So these are very technical and complex multi-step processes. Vitamin C starts with a corn ingredient. That's probably the most kind of food-based and natural one of them all. Some of them involve bacteria. And most vitamin manufacturing is actually now happening in China.
And I'll tell you what, it's not just now. People are sometimes shocked to learn that that's been going on probably for three decades. That's really...
Yeah, I mean, China's been involved for a while, but them really taking over the vitamin market has happened probably in the last 15 years, as it's just become too expensive for a lot of the Western companies. Some of the drug companies that used to make vitamins, a lot of them have gotten out of it. And the ones that are still involved, most of their manufacturing is in these big operations in China.
Correct. Like even mostly who makes the actual vitamin extractions, a lot of that are the pharmaceutical companies, such as Pfizer and Merck. And they actually do manufacture these in China. They then import them into the United States where their warehouse and distributors are, and then a vitamin manufacturer usually purchases those ingredients from the United States, and then if consumers call them, they'll say, oh no, they're all from the United States because they're making the supplement in the United States. But yet the source of the manufacturing of that raw ingredient truly is China. That is often the case.
Right, and they'll do the mixing of the raw vitamin into various supplements and mixes, whether it goes into food or a pill, they'll do that in the United States, right? So, yeah, that's the global supply chain that we have.
Right, so there's a lot of, let's say, smoke and mirrors that people may not have been aware of, but which you elucidate in depth in your book, Pandora's Lunchbox, how processed food took over the American meal. Now, also, in terms of corn, like you talk about ascorbic acid, which is basically vitamin C, and also citric acid is manufactured similarly. So you're talking about it's made from corn. Now, what about the growing consciousness in terms of the use of genetically modified ingredients?
Yeah, exactly. There's a growing movement in the U.S. I mean, it's long been prevalent in Europe, but it's gaining in the U.S., where people really want to know, people are surprised to learn that genetically modified foods are, or ingredients, I should say, are rampant in the supermarket and at fast food restaurants, and that most of the corn and soybeans and cotton, although that's not really a food crop, so it's really corn and soybeans that are grown in the U.S., it's, you know, above 90%, are genetically modified. So this is a huge transformation that's happened. It all started in 1996, which is not that long ago. So I think most people are surprised to learn that. And they, you know, genetically modified technology is very, it's very technical and complex, and it's very difficult to understand what's actually going on and what some of the consequences might be of this technology. And we don't know all the consequences so far. So I think people want to know, even if they're okay with eating it, they want to know, is it in my food? So there's a huge movement underway to get genetically modified ingredients when they're in food to get it labeled on the box.
And there's a great movement by the commercial food producers, grocery store management, et cetera, to block that from happening. Why? Because almost every single processed food will have to say contains genetically modified ingredients, and so will all the vitamins.
Right, a lot of the vitamins, yeah. So I think that fear is a little bit unfounded by the food industry. I mean, there's a lot of different things that are on boxes in the supermarket. I mean, lots of different things are labeled. You can look and see how much sugar is in there, and people know sugar is not great for you, and it has to list allergens. And you know, cans of Diet Coke have to say that it aspartame can cause problems for people that have a certain health condition. And so there's lots of information on these boxes, and it's not going to make people necessarily stop buying these. I mean, some people will look at it and say, okay, I'm going to search out other alternatives. But I think it's just something that the food industry needs to accept and realize that this is a good thing, that people really do need transparency, and you can't just pretend it doesn't matter.
Well, I love the fact that I've been working against genetically modified food. Let me tell you since when, Melanie, since 1969, because that's when it actually started, and I was working at the time at Cornell University as a student aide in a laboratory, and that's when they started doing the research on it. So since then, I've seen, you know, basically the diabolical nature of this stuff and the fact that it was totally unregulated and unannounced. And as you said correctly, it's actually been in the food supply aggressively since 1996 on an ever-escalating amount. And I am so pleased that people like yourself who wrote Pandora's Lunchbox and really people all over the country are actually, this seems to be such a big movement. And then I would have to really thank Jeffrey Smith, because he is the one who focused the message on, instead of stop GMO foods, which would be great, just focus on one issue. If we all put our attention on just the labeling laws, that might be something we can get through, because that has to make sense even to people who prefer to eat genetically modified food. So why not have it labeled? Good, I like it, so it'll tell me which ones to eat. I mean, it's just about knowledge. I mean, that's something, there was really no good argument against it. However,
exactly. I mean, it's part of our American culture to have consumer choice. You know, you need to put it on the label, put it on the box, so people can make up their own mind. You know, don't put it in there and expect people to just blindly accept it.
That is so true. Well, we're going to go just to another break right here, where we're going to allow all the other wonderful shows right here on PRN. People can tune in any time, and you will hear that on our little promo break right now. When we come back, we will continue our discussion with author Melanie Werner, and we'll be talking about more information that she has in Pandora's Lunchbox, how processed food took over the American meal. We'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And welcome back once again to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right here on Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM, Gary Knowles Network. And this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, asking you to come on board and visit us at naturalnurse.com or have a comment at Facebook, The Natural Nurse. Facebook, The Natural Nurse, Ellen Kamai. We'd love to hear from you. In fact, we have gotten many viewers listening to radio shows elsewhere and telling us that they love to hear the guest there. They'd like us to bring them on. And, of course, many people, and we invite you to join us on ground. That means in person at lectures and workshops. We have one coming up in Chinatown, New York City, where you will learn tongue and pulse diagnosis and learn all about Chinese herbs. We also have one coming up at Stony Brook University, and that will be held at the Stony Brook Southampton campus, and that is a major evidence-based natural medicine symposium, which also offers 5 CEU credits for professionals, and it is also available to the public, so you can come on board and join us there, as well as many herbal classes where we look, go outside and gather edible and medicinal plants. So all kinds of ways to join in. And that is actually how we got our guest today. Pandora's Lunchbox is the book. Melanie Werner is the author. And I actually heard Melanie on, I think it was Democracy Now!, Melanie, that I heard you, you were a guest on there, which is a major show.
Sure. I think that was way back in March.
Yes, and that's, you know, somebody heard you on there and recommended to me, which we love our listeners to do, hey, I heard this great and knowledgeable guest who just wrote a new book, and then, I'm happy to have information like that from our listeners, and you really are a great book, a great guest with a fabulous book, Pandora's Lunchbox. What is the picture of that on the front of your book? Is that processed cheese that everybody loves?
It is. It is a picture of processed cheese. Yeah, processed cheese.
Now, that's one of the things that really has been around a very long time.
It was one of the first enduring processed food products. Yeah, it was created about 1915 by a man named J.L. Kraft, who went on to form the multi-billion dollar Kraft Corporation, which is now split up and has different names, but still known as Kraft.
And that's another thing, the industrialization of all this processed food, without too much thought to nutrition, that's for sure. Now, things that people think might be healthy, let's say canola oil. You have a wonderful entire section discussing the various oils, like soybean oil and canola oil, and, yeah, you know, how they're produced, and yet they can be labeled as 100% natural. Tell us about that.
Yeah, if you go to the supermarket and you pick up bottles of cooking oil, you'll see that they're labeled, or some of them are labeled, 100% natural. But if there were anything, if you could look behind the label and see how these oils, particularly I focus mostly on soybean oil in the book, but a lot of the vegetable oils are produced in similar ways, the notion of 100% natural would be laughable. I mean, take away the fact that they're starting with genetically modified soybeans or corn or canola. The manufacturing process that it goes through is incredibly complex. And as I referenced earlier, it starts with a fairly industrial petrochemical called hexane, which is very dangerous and neurotoxic. The food industry says only small traces of it remain in the final oil product. But even traces of it are, you know, probably not so good to be consuming on any regular basis over a lifetime, certainly. And And then to bleaching and deodorizing and refining, it goes through a whole series of steps. And you have to do so much to it to get these oils to actually taste good. Because soybean oil doesn't, I mean, soybean oil is something that's relatively new to the human diet. We were never consuming soybean oils. There were just maybe small amounts in China that had been consumed throughout the century. But essentially, it's not an oil that we've ever had the ability to extract. I mean, soybeans are these little brittle beans, and they don't actually contain very much oil. So in order to efficiently extract it, you need to have this complex chemical and industrial machinery, which we now have. It started about in the 30s, and the production of it has just ramped up since then. And soybean oil is now actually the dominant oil or the dominant fat that's in our diet, and this has been true for the last several decades.
Yeah. Thank you. That was excellent. And, of course, also when we talk about canola oil, there is no such thing as a canola.
Yeah, right.
It's a made-up name.
Yeah. In Canada, I think they, or certainly in Europe, they call it rapeseed oil, which was, it doesn't sound as good. So, yeah, and it's a result of breeding technology to create an ideal bean to grow for oil.
Right, quite amazing, all the things we don't know. Now, you stated in your book, Pandora's Lunchbox, that there are more than 5,000 additives that are allowed, and yet, as we come up with new ingredients, the food industry does not actually have to let the FDA know about it, nor do they have to actually do testing.
Yeah, exactly. I think this is probably a surprise to a lot of people.
It's actually a surprise to me.
That ingredient makers don't have to do any real testing on their new ingredients. There are about more than half of the ingredients that are in the food supply have not been tested. It's probably well over half. And that was research that was done. The Pew Research Group of Pew Charitable Trust has done some great research on that. So that was data coming from them. And the fact that the ingredient companies don't even have to tell the FDA about, not only have to do testing, but then don't even have to tell the FDA about a new ingredient, it's a huge loophole in FDA additive regulation. And it's something that really needs to be closed. It's just, it makes no sense. And Pew has estimated that there's about 1,000, at least 1,000 of these, I call them ghost additives, that are that have been launched into the market in the last 10 years. And it's impossible. That's just an estimate because it's impossible to know. Nobody knows.
That is amazing. I love that word, ghost ingredients. In other words, they're kind of hidden. And let me just put out from a little bit more of a scientific perspective the fact that not only are many of these ingredients not even brought up or mentioned anywhere, not even tested, and just going one little step deeper, there's no testing done on what the interaction between all these chemicals create in terms of free radicals and other kinds of species that can be very, very harmful to our health.
Yeah.
I mean, if you take one neurotoxin, which we know, for instance, is there, as they may state in a very small amount, and then you take another neurotoxin, which is there also but not even claimed, those two things can interact as chemicals.
Yeah, exactly. So, I'd really like to think as a consumer, as a mom, that most of these 5,000 food ingredients that can go into, or additives, I should call them, not really even food, additives that go into food are safe, or at least they're safe when they're consumed on their own. But that's never the case. I mean, you can, at one point I sat down and added up the number of ingredients in a Subway sandwich. I mean, most people think that Subway is sort of the healthy fast food chain. And if you just look at calories and maybe fat levels, it does look a little bit healthier. But when you look at their ingredients, this doesn't look like fresh, wholesome, super healthy food. So I counted up in just one of their Subway sandwiches 105 ingredients. And most of
even though that's not what it looks like. It looks like a tomato and a piece of lettuce and mayonnaise or something like that.
Yeah,
but you're looking at what all these things are made out of.
Right. And most of those ingredients are things that you would not have in your home kitchen, things that are just not familiar food ingredients. So the point with that is that the way we're consuming additives is in multiple quantities all at once. We're not just consuming one thing at one time. And that's something that the food industry really, I mean, it's really impossible to test for that, the interactions of all these chemicals. And there have been, and I talk about in the book, instances where there are known interactions. There was one case in beverages where two chemicals were, or two additives were interacting to create a carcinogenic compound. So it does happen, and it's just a risk that you take on in eating large quantities of processed food over time.
Right, and I believe, and I'm wondering if you might be referring to the fact that they use benzoate as a preservative, and when benzoate comes in contact with any kind of particularly vitamin C or other antioxidants, right, it can break down into benzene. So while benzoate is not carcinogenic, benzene is. And I do want to do a shout out because I know there are many supplement manufacturers that also use in these things that are considered very healthy benzoate as preservatives.
Yeah, exactly. That is the instance that I'm talking about. And the beverage manufacturers have since corrected for that. So I think that came to light in 2006. But yeah, that's one. And interestingly, sodium benzoate is one of these food ingredients. It's been around since close to the turn of the century. It's been in food. There's been concerns raised about it at that time, but it's been in our food for a very long time. So I'm not sure that that means that it's safe, you know, but it's something that we're consuming widely in our food.
Yes, it certainly is. And so that bringing that out is wonderful. And I want to thank you for all the great research that you did putting together Pandora's Lunchbox. What is your, you know, why did you want to come out with this book? What made you work so hard putting this whole thing together?
Well, I want to just contribute to the conversation about how our food systems need to change. There's been a lot of discussion, and there's been a lot of books and movies, and so many people are doing wonderful work on this, and I just wanted to be a part of that and contribute to getting Americans to just to think a little bit more consciously about how they eat and understanding, connecting all the dots between. My book is predominantly focused on the role between food and health, but there's other implications in terms of the environment as well. So just to get people to just care a little bit more about what they put into their mouth and to know the story behind their food, because you really can't make good food choices until you know how your food is produced and what goes into it, and just know a little bit more about the whole story.
And if you don't want to go into all that, just like you're saying, just buy whole pieces of food that looks like something that grew.
Yeah.
You know, if you
can't
afford
organic,
get a regular.
Less confusing to people, because there's so many, people get so many confusing messages about, you know, this health study says this and this says the other thing, and don't eat red meat, or red meat's okay, or eggs are bad and now eggs are good. And it's, to me, it's very simple. I mean, I do believe that eating organic and pastured animals is the ideal, but it's not affordable to everyone. And I think it's not necessary for people to jump to that significantly higher next level in health. So I really just want to make it simple for people and distinguish between these highly processed food creations and real fresh food. Because once you make that distinction, your food choices become a lot clearer and just much more simple.
Well, thank you so much, and you certainly did bring that awareness to consumers. Get the book, Pandora's Lunchbox, How Processed Food Took Over the American Meal, written by Melanie Warner. You can find out more about Melanie at melaniewarner.com. And I want to thank you so much for joining us today right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And you can always find us at naturalnurse.com or on Facebook, The Natural Nurse. Until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse. And as always, myself and my co-host, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, we're hoping that you stay healthy.